Hello there. Today is Tuesday, December the 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up.
And as it went up onto that pavement, it just knocked right through crowds of people.
A deadly attack on a Christmas market in Berlin. An ambassador is assassinated in cold blood. Donald Trump officially has been elected the next president of the United States. Also ahead, the scoop on the new Star Trek movie. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, police in Berlin say a truck ran into a crowded Christmas market in the center of Berlin, killing at least 12 people, causing many more injuries. Joining us now for the latest is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, what else can you tell us about what happened?
It was late in the evening, just after 8 o'clock local time, when a very large lorry laden with steel went up onto the pavement alongside a Christmas market in western section of Berlin. And as it went up onto that pavement, it just knocked right through crowds of people. So far, police are saying that there are at least 48 injured, some of them seriously. The reason why there are so many people injured is because it is one of the hearts of Berlin. It's the Christmas market. It has been a Christmas market there almost for centuries. This is part of what makes Berlin, and in fact Germany, special. These Christmas markets that people go to, they're not big commercial types of market, but people are attracted to them because there's a lot of Christmas cheer there. You go there to buy little presents to put in your stockings, and you also go there to get traditional food. This market has been part of the community for a long time. So when this truck came out of nowhere, it was really a complete shock to people. And even though there have been threats, there have been alerts by the US State Department that this type of attack could take place at these types of Christmas markets throughout Europe, people still can't believe it. And we still don't have a complete picture of what happened. We have very incomplete information.
Are they calling this a terrorist attack, and do they have any idea what the motive might have been?
No, they are not calling it a terrorist attack at this stage. They do not know anything about the motive. They do say, police in Berlin are saying that they have arrested the man that they believe was the driver of the truck. He is in custody. However, the passenger in that truck died. What is unclear is, first of all, this is a truck that came from Poland. It's owned by a Polish haulage company. Who was driving that? Was that the person who was meant to be driving the truck? Well, the people that own the truck say, no, he could not have done it. Is there a question that perhaps the truck was hijacked? All these things. And then perhaps at the end of the day, was it an accident? A lot of people are saying it doesn't seem that way. The truck mounted the pavement. It went for about 80 meters through the crowd before it came to a stop. It was going at quite a speed. It was going at about 60 kilometers an hour. And they're also drawing parallels to the attack in France, in southern France, in Nice, in the middle of July, when 86 people died, when a lorry plowed into the crowds along the promenade there. So these types of parallels are being made. There's also a lot of talk reminding everyone that back in September 2014, a spokesman for the so-called Islamic State called on supporters to not go for big types of attacks, but rather to use any means they could. And that message, he said, you can even run over them with a car. And so that's also being used as an example that if this was an attack, there is the possibility that it was, if you like, inspired by that propaganda, that type of advice, rather than actually being orchestrated from the so-called Islamic State.
This is so reminiscent of what happened in Nice, and yet another unexpected location.
One thing in particular with this particular Berlin Christmas market is that the area was not cordoned off around it. There were no, you know, big concrete blocks which would have stopped the truck from getting through. There were nothing like that. I mean, we're seeing at other Christmas markets in Europe, particularly, say, for example, the Strasbourg Christmas market, one of the world's oldest Christmas markets. That is actually now completely surrounded by concrete barriers and trucks can't get in. So whilst we're seeing that in places like Munich and also in Strasbourg, that wasn't the case in Berlin. And that's also the question. Is it perhaps time that the Berlin police went back and looked again at the security measures they had in place at that market?
All right. Paris-based journalist Catherine Field, we appreciate it so much. Thank you. Well, also on Monday in the Turkish capital of Ankara, the Russian ambassador was shot dead, reportedly by a Turkish policeman while attending the opening of an exhibition. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the assassination is being linked to Syria.
The shooting of the Russian ambassador, Andrei Karlov, was captured by video cameras recording his speech opening an exhibition in a gallery in the heart of Ankara. As the ambassador was speaking, a gunman approached the podium and opened fire, shooting Karlov 4 to 5 times. 3 other people were also injured. One witness explains that Syria appears to be the motivation for the attack. He shot him behind the podium, she said. The assailant was saying, Allah Akbar. He mentioned that Russia was killing innocent people in Aleppo and in Syria. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
Well, the ambassador's assassination appears to be another indication of the growing desperation and outrage over the humanitarian crisis in Syria. The UN Security Council on Monday unanimously did approve a resolution urging quick deployment of monitors to oversee the evacuation of civilians from Aleppo. But there have been reports of people evacuation buses having valuables stolen and men of fighting age being detained. The conditions on the ground are dire, as described by the head of the UN-backed humanitarian task force for Syria, Jan Egeland, in Geneva.
Operations are now happening in basements without anesthesia. Imagine having your child rushed to an unsanitary basement and then being operated upon without anesthesia. These are the conditions today in East Aleppo.
All right. Well, we're now joined by Matthew Saltmarsh. He's the spokesperson for UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, for an update on the evacuation of those civilians. Thanks so much for being with us. What's the latest?
The latest that we have is that evacuations of civilians from eastern Aleppo have been proceeding Monday. Those have been conducted by partners of UN agencies, primarily SARC and ICRC. And that earlier today we had reports that around about 3,500 people had been evacuated. That number could be slightly higher because we haven't had reports directly back from the field for a while. But overall, since the 16th of December, somewhere over 10,000 people have been evacuated from Aleppo to the west, primarily to Idlib province.
Do you have any idea at this point how many people are left and still need to be rescued?
Very, very difficult to say because the situation has been so fluid in recent days. We know that a number of people, tens of thousands, have sought shelter in temporary refuges and community centers around Aleppo. And of course, some people will have had their own means and will have been able to get out of the city and stay with contacts and friends as well. Actually doing a count of people is impossible at this stage.
How will you know when you have completed the mission?
Well, we will keep supporting those partners that are evacuating people from eastern Aleppo as long as we can and as long as there is demand to do so. So until that sort of flow of civilians dries up, then we'll keep working to help transport them to safer areas.
Given what you know about the situation, how dire is this on the ground there? And how dangerous is it for even agencies like yours to go in there and assist people?
Well, we know that the humanitarian situation in Aleppo is awful right now. There are still areas that we can't get access to, but we do have access to people who have been displaced from eastern Aleppo into shelters around Aleppo. And we know that the conditions are very poor. It's below freezing at night. These people are staying in temporary shelters that we're trying to help rehabilitate, but it's very cold. There are people who are hungry, who have lacked medical support for many, many months now. And we and partners, other UN agencies, are trying to do the best we can where we have access. We do have humanitarian aid and stocks that are available both in and around Aleppo and also in nearby Turkey. But the problem until now has been actually getting those stocks into Aleppo and getting access to the people that we need to support.
And being that you are a refugee agency, it would appear there's nothing for these people to go back to. So how big of an issue is it to accommodate all these people in neighboring countries and elsewhere in the world?
It's correct to say that obviously everyone has seen the images, and Aleppo is in a state of ruin right now. So very many of the people will have nothing to go back to, even if they were to want to go back there now. So it's really a question of managing the displacement as best we can as a humanitarian agency and with our partners on the ground. And that involves a number of solutions. Initially, the majority of those evacuated have gone to neighboring areas within Syria. But as you know, there are many millions of Syrian refugees in neighboring countries already, and conditions there are also very difficult. Turkey, for example, has 2.7 million Syrian refugees. Lebanon has over 1 million. So there is not great appetite in those countries to be accommodating more refugees. But what we would say is one of the best things that the international community can do is to support those neighboring countries, which have obviously been under a great strain doing what they can throughout the Syrian war.
All right. Well, we appreciate your bringing us this update. Matthew Saltmarsh, spokesperson for the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. And by the way, the UN Children's Agency says 47 children in an orphanage in the rebel-held section of eastern Aleppo have been evacuated to safety, though some are in critical condition. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Farming without soil is seen as a solution in land without water. New York man gets 30 years in prison for a plot against Muslims. Sanctions reinforce North Korea's siege mentality. And who answers letters to Santa Claus? Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Michael Lippin is joining us now for what's been trending on social media, and I know there's been lots of reaction to what's been happening in Berlin, Ankara, and elsewhere. Michael, what are you seeing?
Hi, Laurie. Well, it's been quite a grim day in Europe, as you've been reporting, with those attacks in Berlin, Ankara, and also in Switzerland's largest city of Zurich. There was actually a third attack on Monday in Zurich, where authorities say an unidentified gunman shot and wounded three men inside a mosque while they were praying before the gunman fled. As for how social media responded, when you look at the deadliest incident in Berlin, one of the city's top daily newspapers, Berliner Morgenpost, got attention on Facebook for streaming a live video from the scene of the Christmas market minutes after that truck plowed through it. In the clip, you can see many people walking around in confusion, some people on the ground, and debris everywhere. You know, as I was reading through the comments from the live stream, translated from German into English, I saw that many people were criticizing the German reporter for actually walking through the market rather than stopping to help wounded people. And then there were other people on Facebook saying, no, let the reporter do his job and actually show people what's going on there.
Wow. So what kind of Twitter reaction have you been seeing on Monday's events?
Well, hashtag PrayForBerlin was one of the top Twitter world trends. But that hashtag PrayForBerlin also got some pushback. An Irish YouTube video star, Melanie Murphy, wrote this: "I'm done with PrayFor hashtags. We need real-life compassion instead of killing, education and strengthen ideas instead of violence. Act." And then I noticed a tweet from a Russian-French journalist with a Radio France International, Elena Servitaz. She summarized what many Twitter users were feeling on Monday, writing, "I want this horrible day to be over. Hashtag Berlin, hashtag Zurich, hashtag Ankara." And then she added hashtag Aleppo, reminding us that there is major human suffering going on in that Syrian city, too.
Okay, and circling back to U.S. news, there is a big social media story here as well.
That's right, Lori. It was the U.S. Electoral College members or electors meeting today to ratify Donald Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton in last month's presidential election. Now, the candidate who won the most votes in each state typically gets all of the Electoral College votes from that state, with the winner needing a majority of at least 270. Trump himself acknowledged the Electoral College vote with this tweet today. "We did it. Thank you to all of my great supporters. We just officially won the election, despite all of the distorted and inaccurate media." And as you know, Lori, that kind of media criticism is pretty standard for the president-elect.
That is very true. Thank you, Michael. You can follow him at Twitter or on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, it is often called the most wonderful time of the year, but Christmas can also be one of the most stressful times of the year and expensive in America anyway. So how can we avoid the consumerism and actually enjoy the holidays? We're joined by New York-based psychotherapist Jonathan Alpert. Thank you for being with us. So tell us, how can we avoid overspending and overindulging?
It's hard not to, considering that here in the United States, this all starts even before Halloween, which is October 31st. So it's hard to avoid this, but there are things that people can do. People can make a decision to simply not buy into it. We don't have to buy extravagant gifts for people and attend 15 different holiday parties. People should know that they actually have some control over what they do. They can, in lieu of gifts, they can maybe cook dinner for a friend or family member, or be creative and provide like some sort of service. So, for example, like babysitting if you have a relative with little kids. So people don't have to buy into the frenzy of the season. And I think people should also really examine like how they think about it. It can be pretty easy to be Scrooge and be really negative about the season, but that's not really going to help anyone here. So people should really keep that in check.
Right. So keep the negativity down.
Sure. And then another thing that I suggest to a lot of my clients is to volunteer, and that's really in the spirit of the holiday season, to give to people that are less fortunate. So, you know, take a half a day or a couple hours and give. And that might be volunteering at a shelter, or helping kids in need, or visiting elderly people at a home. But give back to the community.
That's great.
And then I think something else that people should keep in mind, like how to say no and be okay with it, because there are all sorts of pressures and expectations around the holiday season to attend every party, or, you know, pull off hosting the perfect party. So people should try to be okay saying no and understand that it's it's actually okay. People have to try not to stretch themselves too thin around this time of the year, because likely they're not eating as healthy, they're not maintaining their wellness routine.
That's right. Yes, definitely, certainly put us on the wrong direction of our resolutions to eat better and exercise in the new year. We always appreciate your perspective. Thank you so much. New York-based psychotherapist Jonathan Alpert. Well, every Christmas, children around the world write letters to Santa Claus. But as Erica Celeste reports, while the missives never make it to the North Pole, they do reach Santa Claus, and they're answered.
Welcome to Santa Claus, Indiana. Though the town may be 6,000 kilometers south of the North Pole, the residents are some of Santa's best helpers. That's because every year they get nearly 25,000 letters for the jolly old elf, and they answer every one of them.
From the earliest we know is that the postmaster started answering letters in 1914 that children wrote.
By 1930, the postmaster was overwhelmed. When head elf Pat Cook's father heard, he organized local veterans, the American Legion, area clergy, and the high school typing classes into the first volunteer letter-writing elves. Pat started helping just a little over a decade later. These days, the elves send out one of four form letters that bear positive messages about sharing, being good, and helping others. But they also include a personal note.
We never promise anything, and we never admonish anybody. We just encourage.
Letters arrive year-round, but the bulk of them come in November and December. Chief male elf Ed Reinhardt believes there isn't a country they haven't heard from. And the U.S. Postal Service ensures that the letters get to Indiana no matter the address.
They come in the mail, and that's all they have on it, Santa. Some of them say Santa, North Pole. Some of them say to the guy in the big red suit.
Other times, letters arrive from small children without a stamp or just a sticker in the corner. While they try to answer every letter, the elves are saddened when no return address is included. Their research team tries to track the letters by postmark zip code, but sometimes even that's not enough. So they encourage parents to always check for return addresses before letters are mailed. This year, Hatchimals, iPhones, puppies, and ponies are all big requests from children. But there are plenty of requests from adults, too. Young people in China asked to do well on exams or get into university.
We've had some adults that have asked for a diamond ring or a husband. We've had adults of, you know, ask for healing.
The elves of Santa Claus never dreamed their good deeds would get so much attention. Despite suggestions that people pay for the letters from Santa, they hold firm to their commitment to continue the service for free.
Everything that happens happens because there are good people who care about the real Christmas spirit and the real meaning of Christmas.
For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Santa Claus, Indiana.
Well, 'tis the season on a cold winter night here in the U.S. to see a good movie, and to everyone seems to be talking about Rogue One, a Star Wars story which did soar to the top of the box office over the weekend. And the weekend's other new wide release, the Will Smith drama Collateral Beauty, opened as well. Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard is with us now to talk about both movies, starting with the new Star Wars flick. Jeff, so what's the scoop on this one?
This is a prequel. Remember the original Star Wars in 1977. And the whole movie is based about how R2-D2 had to get the Death Star plans into the hands of the rebels so they could figure out how to destroy this thing. And, of course, a young farm boy named Luke Skywalker, you know, went on the adventure of his life and helped bring down the Empire and the Death Star. But there's a lot of references in that movie to how the Death Star plans came to be. I mean, the mission of that. Remember, she says, Princess Leia says, a lot of people died to get this information to you, you know. So this is a movie about that. So it's essentially a Dirty Dozen, a Suicide Squad, or any of these movies that we see lately where you have a band of people going on, Guardians of the Galaxy even, they're going to steal the Death Star plans, and we have all new characters. But of course, it's girl power, you know, because we have Felicity Jones, who plays Jin, who's rising to the occasion to lead the rebels on this Empire's base on this planet that has a beachfront property, believe it or not. And it's about them essentially, you know, conquering, trying to get these plans and start the Star Wars legacy going. Now, this is part of the anthology series, meaning that this film is standalone. It really doesn't, they're not going to see these characters again. It's a one-time story. And they also have, they have other ones planned for it, too, like Han Solo's origin and Boba Fett. You know, over the next 4 or 5 years, you'll have those.
How was it?
You know, I'm kind of mixed, because overall, it's very adult-oriented, meaning it's got a lot of action. There are a lot of deaths in it. I didn't feel any kind of family-friendly vibe from this at all. This is not for little children. This is not for, you know, little kids. I think maybe at least 13 and older would enjoy it, maybe 12. A lot of people die in this movie. A lot of stormtroopers die. There's, the third act of the film is just solid action when they're attacking the bases and also up in the sky in the space. The ships are flying around and fighting the Empire, and the rebels are battling it up there. So I came out of it going, wow, that really wasn't fun. It was kind of a heavy story. And this is also, I kind of see it again. Believe it or not, I want to see it again to really absorb what's going on in the movie. As everyone knows, Disney made it very public that they did a lot of reshoots on this movie. So I think they put Darth Vader in this because he's got two amazing scenes in the film. You want more of him in this 2.5 hour movie. So there's only a little bit of Darth Vader. So that was really frustrating. I think some of the characters and the performances were outstanding, but I just thought the movie was just kind of dull.
Well, so we also have another new movie out, Will Smith's new movie. Tell us about that one.
Yes, it's called Collateral Beauty. And Will Smith is a successful New York advertising executive, along with his partners, played by Edward Norton and Kate Winslet. But Will Smith's character suffers a great tragedy. He loses his young daughter, who's like 6 years old. So he really retreats from his life. He retreats from his friends, and he retreats from his company. So while his friends are just desperately trying to get him to reconnect with him and get him back into life, he starts doing weird things, like writing letters to time, love, and death. And here's the weird part. They answer. So Helen Mirren shows up and shows the letter, goes, yes, you wrote to me, you know, or Keira Knightley is playing love. And she's like, oh, here's the letter you wrote to me. Or Jacob Lattimore, who's the R&B singer and the hip-hop star, he's playing time. So Will Smith is like, am I losing my mind? It's almost like It's a Wonderful Life kind of story, because it does have a Christmas theme, or a holiday film. Overall, though, I just think the movie's too heavy. I mean, we deal with cancer. We're dealing with childhood death. We're dealing with all these heavy issues. And even though you need to bring a box of Kleenex, it pushes all the buttons, Lori. You're going to be bawling your eyes out. But Will Smith, wonderful performances, but it's just a heavy film and heavy subject matter. I just don't think it's going to catch on with a lot of people during the Christmas season.
Jeffrey K. Howard, you can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Most often, these are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. Such is the case with Abdullah Ahmed al-Mishadani, Abdelila Haimik, and Basil Hassan. All three are involved in the external operations of the Foreign Terrorist Organization and Specially Designated Global Terrorist Group, ISIL, also known as Daesh. Iraqi national Abdullah Ahmed al-Mishadani works with foreign terrorist fighters who choose to join ISIL. He handles their accommodation and arranges transportation for suicide bombers. Abdelila Haimik, also known as Abu Suleiman al-Faransi, is a Moroccan-born senior foreign fighter for ISIL. In 2015, Haimik created the Tariq ibn Zayed Battalion, a foreign fighter cell composed primarily of Europeans. This group, which once numbered as many as 300, operates on behalf of ISIL and conducts attacks in Iraq, Syria, as well as outside of the Middle East. Basil Hassan is a Lebanon-born Dane who is an external operations plotter for ISIL. He is accused of an attempted assassination in 2013 of 70-year-old Danish author and journalist Lars Hedegaard. He was arrested in Turkey in 2014, but was later released, allegedly as part of an exchange for 49 hostages held by ISIL. Under Executive Order 13224, Abdullah Ahmed al-Mishadani, Abdelila Haimik, and Basil Hassan have been named by the U.S. Department of State as specially designated global terrorists, and their names have been placed on the specially designated terrorist list. This means that their assets within U.S. reach have been frozen, and they are locked out of the global financial network. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with them. In this way, the United States disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. By designating Abdullah Ahmed al-Masadani, Abdelilah Khaimik, and Basil Hassan as global terrorists, the United States hopes to hinder the deadly agenda of these terrorists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.